everybody. Welcome to North Coast Chronicles podcast, Tales from the Great Lakes. I'm your host, Helen Prohl. Join me every month on the American Shoreline Podcast Network, ASPN, as we explore the nature, folklore, and charm of the Great Lakes, America's fourth seacoast. Check out the plethora of podcasts on ASPN related to our oceans, coasts, and inland systems at coastalnewstoday.com. Today's episode is re-examining the storm that sunk the Edmund Fitzgerald. Joining us is Tom Hulquist, the Science and Operations Officer for the National Weather Service in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Though Tom grew up in Rhode Island and has his BS in meteorology from Linden State College in Vermont, he began his career with the National Weather Service in 1994 at the Weather Forecast Office in Grand Rapids, Michigan. In 2001, he became the Science Officer at the National Weather Service Forecast Office in Marquette, Michigan, where he completed weather-related research on the November 1975 storm in which the Edmund Fitzgerald perished. As noted, he's currently with the National Weather Service in Minneapolis. So please, you could join us today on North Coast Chronicles, Tom.
Thank you, Helen. It's really great to be here.
And with us, as always, is our trusty engineer, Tyler Buckingham. But Tyler's not feeling well. So while he is engineering today, he is not available to share his thoughts. And we're so sad for him, but I know you all join me in wishing him a speedy recovery. Last month on the podcast, we had as our guest Catherine Tozinski, who is a physical research scientist with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Coastal and Hydraulics Laboratory. We talked about resilience of the Great Lakes marine transportation system, but really, many principles for assessing and responding to resilience apply to any coastal area. First, you have to know the baseline state of resilience to understand what the requirements might be for infrastructure, how to respond when resilience is compromised, or if there are operating procedures that might change. The factors that might impact resilience in the Great Lakes could be different, strong storms instead of hurricanes, let's say, but the principles for recovery and response are similar. On November 10, 1975, the Great Lakes bulk cargo vessel SS Edmund Fitzgerald sank with the loss of all 29 crew members in eastern Lake Superior, about 17 miles from the entrance to Whitefish Bay, Michigan, during a severe storm. The vessel sank quickly without sending a distress signal and, as we all know, the tragedy inspired Gordon Lightfoot to write Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. According to the website called ssedmundfitzgerald.org, the timeline for the Edmund Fitzgeralds is as follows. On November 9th, about 2:20 p.m., the Edmund Fitzgerald departs Lake Superior en route to Detroit with over 26,000 tons of taconite pellets. Only a little bit later, the National Weather Service issues gale warnings for the area in which the Fitzgerald would be sailing. And then a short time after that, another Great Lakes ship, the Arthur M. Anderson, left Two Harbors, Minnesota, with similar tonnage aboard, and was also headed eastbound, but to Gary, Indiana. Both ship captains decided to take a northerly route to keep in the lee of the forecasted northerly gale winds. Captain Cooper from the Anderson radioed the Fitzgerald that he is 15 miles behind. In the early hours of November 10th, the report from the Fitzgerald shows her to be 20 miles south of Isle Royale. Winds were at 52 knots with waves 10 feet in height. 6 hours later, the Fitzgerald reports that winds are at 35 knots with waves of 10 feet. And at 3:15 p.m., the SS Arthur M. Anderson watches the Fitzgerald round Caribou Island and comments that the Fitzgerald is much closer to Six Fathom Shoal than he would want it to be. Just a few minutes later, the Anderson reports that winds were coming from the northwest at 43 knots. So obviously the wind has been variable, but still consistently strong. A few minutes after that, there is a radio transmission between the Fitzgerald and the Anderson. Captain McSorley of the Fitzgerald spoke to Captain Cooper. Anderson, this is the Fitzgerald. I have sustained some topside damage. I have a fence rail laid down, two vents lost or damaged, and a list. I'm checking down. Will you stay by me till I get to Whitefish? The Anderson responds affirmatively, but asks, do you have your pumps going? And the Fitzgerald said, yes, both of them. Just 30 minutes later, the Fitzgerald radios the Anderson requesting radar assistance for the remainder of the voyage. Anderson, this is the Fitzgerald. I have lost both radars. Can you provide me with radar plots till we reach Whitefish Bay? Charlie on that, Fitzgerald, will keep you advised of the position. By 4:39 p.m., the Fitzgerald cannot pick up the Whitefish Point radio beacon. The Fitzgerald radios a Coast Guard station at Grand Marais on Channel 16, the emergency channel. They call for any vessel in the Whitefish Point area regarding information about the beacon and light at Whitefish Point. They receive an answer by the saltwater vessel Avifors that the beacon and the light are not operating. Estimated between 5:30 and 6 p.m. that same evening, there is a radio transmission between the Abafors and the Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald, this is the Abafors. I have the Whitefish light now, but I'm still receiving no beacon. Fitzgerald says, I'm very glad to hear it. The Abafors says, the wind is really howling down here. What are the conditions where you are? The captain of the Fitzgerald says, I have a bad list, lost both radars, and I'm taking heavy seas over the deck. One of the worst seas I've ever been in. And Abafors says, if I'm correct, you have two radars. And the Fitzgerald responds, they're both gone. Sometime around 7 p.m., the Anderson is struck by two huge waves that put water on the ship 35 feet above the waterline. The Anderson is still following the Fitzgerald and radios. Fitzgerald, we were about 10 miles behind you and gaining about 1.5 hours per hour. And there are other conversations about their respective locations. Anderson asks, by the way, Fitzgerald, how are you making out with your problem? The captain of the Fitzgerald responds, we are holding our own. The captain back says, okay, fine. I'll be talking to you later. But they do not talk later. Still in the Lake Superior, their Fitzgerald enters a squall which obscures the vessel from radar observation by the Anderson. At 7:20 p.m., Edmund Fitzgerald disappears from the radar on the Anderson, prompting a call to the Coast Guard to inform them of the situation. The Anderson calls again and informs Coast Guard that they have lost the Fitzgerald both visually and on radar. There is so much written about the last moments of the Edmund Fitzgerald, and I want to emphasize that this podcast is not about the condition of the ship at that time, the actions of the captain or crew, nor of any rescue response, but we will talk about that storm. Tom Holquist, thank you again for joining us. You've spent your meteorological career with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's National Weather Service, and in particular, with the National Weather Service in the Great Lakes. What does a science officer do?
Yeah, once again, thank you, Helen, for having me. Well, a science and operations officer is a position that's basically in every weather forecast office with the National Weather Service, and we are responsible for the operations, the training, and any local research that occurs in a forecast office. So that kind of includes training of the staff on, you know, how to forecast different phenomena, what tools and techniques to use to make sure we're abreast of any new developments, any new technology, those sorts of things. And then it's to ensure that the products and the services that we provide are basically the best we can do. And then to make sure that that's the case, we conduct ongoing research, you know, as time and resources permit, to try to address any areas where we feel we have shortcomings or we feel there could be improvement, you know, in the services that we provide.
Thank you. Well, with your experience in the Great Lakes, I mean, what can you tell us about the nature of weather in the Great Lakes region? And is it very different from the Upper Lakes to the Lower Lakes?
Well, much like, you know, it seems everywhere in the country, people will always remark that they have the most difficult weather or the most challenging weather. And I think that is true to some extent. It's just the challenges vary from location to location across the country. And in the Great Lakes, there are some unique challenges, you know, in terms of both weather. You know, there are things that we experience that other parts of the country don't. Lake effect snow, obviously, you know, being one of those major things that is different in the Great Lakes area. Along with that, the big changes we have, you know, in temperature and in precipitation as you move, you know, closer to or farther from the lakes. And then obviously, you know, in terms of what we're talking about here today, there's a large marine component to the meteorology in the Great Lakes. And from a weather service perspective, you know, we do marine forecasting in the Great Lakes, whereas if I was working in an office in Nebraska, that would not be one of the areas that I would focus on. But working both in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and then in Marquette, Michigan, you know, we had to do a lot of marine forecasting in terms of wind and wave expectations on the lakes, you know, from the short term out several days, you know, in order to try to give mariners and others a heads up on what would be occurring. And in terms of the upper versus lower lakes, the biggest difference, you know, with Lake Superior and even Michigan and Huron versus Ontario and Erie is obviously size is a huge difference between the sizes of the lakes. And the larger the lake is, the greater potential there is for larger waves. Basically, the longer the fetch or the distance over which winds can travel on the water, the larger waves that can be generated. The depth of the water also plays a factor in that. And, you know, Lake Erie is unique in that it is very shallow in comparison to some of the other lakes. So it would tend to have smaller waves due to that and also choppier conditions than what you would see, you know, on Lake Superior. And in Lake Superior itself, you know, where the Fitzgerald was lost, could actually hold in volume the entirety of the other four Great Lakes and three additional Lake Eries. So it really is massive when you think of it in that context.
Thank you, Tom. So you, we've talked about this a little bit on the podcast that the size of waves are primarily generated on the Great Lakes through wind speed and then the distance that the wind goes across the lakes for the fetch in which they're generated. And this is a very broad question, but is it, would one say that the waves are bigger on Superior versus Michigan or Huron? Or, I mean, I'm from Lake Erie and I know they can be big, but, you know, the chop is real short. How would you describe kind of the way they're geographically situated and the way the wind comes across them?
Sure. You know, in a general context, you know, Lake Superior would have the greatest potential for the largest waves, just given its size. And the other thing is, because of its size, the wind direction isn't as much of a factor as it is on the other waves, on the other lakes. Lake Erie and Lake Ontario, you can have a very long fetch, but the wind direction needs to be, you know, pretty specific. For Lake Erie, it would need to be generally out of the west-southwest, and for Ontario, it would need to be more out of the due west to really maximize that fetch or that distance over which the winds would be able to generate the waves. Whereas on Superior, because it's so large, the direction is not as much of a factor. There's usually somewhere on the lake where you can really maximize fetch and really allow for waves to grow. Huron and Lakes Michigan can get waves similar in size to Lake Superior more easily than, say, Erie or Ontario, but still it's not quite as easy on those lakes to really maximize the fetch. And then a final component that goes into the wave wave size is not only, you know, the wind speeds and the distance over which they travel, but also temperatures do play a role. Whereas if you have colder temperatures in the air flowing over warmer waters, it tends to be able to build waves more quickly and larger, basically, in terms of size, which is why the fall or the autumn tends to be one of the seasons where we usually see the largest waves on the Great Lakes, because the water is at its warmest point and the air temperature is getting colder as we move through the fall and into winter.
Tom, November gale is common terminology in the lakes because of storms that take place in November, obviously. Even Gordon Lightfoot referred to the gales of November. It's kind of crazy that they tend to happen a lot, like right in the mid part of November. It is, as you would say, I guess that's just that time when, is it the water turning over or it's the warm water meeting colder air?
To a large extent, it's the latter. It's the clash of warm water temperatures and colder air as we change seasons. We can obviously get strong storms. You know, we see them throughout the winter and even into the spring time frame. But as we move through winter, the Great Lakes will get colder. There'll be even ice formation. So in terms of wave generation, the potential for that decreases as you move through the season. So really, the fall time frame is where, at least climatologically, the conditions are sort of at their peak for both getting strong storms to move through the region and have conditions that are conducive to the generation of large waves.
Thank you. You had written in a piece that I'll refer to in just a minute, that autumn season is obviously a time that you have the most intense storms and record in the Great Lakes region, and a lot of them in November. Are there other noteworthy gales of November in the Great Lakes or history and the timeline?
Yes, there have been, you know, some significant storms, particularly in the month of November in the Great Lakes and in the Upper Great Lakes in particular. A few of the most noteworthy were a storm in November of 1913 and the Armistice Day storm, which occurred in 1940 during the month of November. And then more recently, there was actually an intense storm that affected Lakes Michigan, Huron, and Lake Superior that occurred essentially the same time frame, the 9th through the 11th of November, but in 1998. And that actually occurred while I was working at the National Weather Service in Grand Rapids. So I was able to sort of experience that storm firsthand. And the big thing we've seen over time with some of these storms is the intensities, obviously, they were fairly similar between all of these storms. The 1913 was the most destructive in terms of loss of ships and loss of life. And then that most recent event that I mentioned in 1998, we luckily avoided any of those tragedies.
Today, just speaking today, if mariners or boaters, anybody needs to understand marine forecasts and where to find them, how does one do that today?
Well, today, it's things have obviously changed dramatically over time. And I would say, you know, for recreational boaters, much of the information you need to find is available online. You know, you can find information through the National Weather Service for the Great Lakes. It's basically at weather.gov/Great Lakes, all one word on that. But, and you'll have very detailed information in terms of hourly forecasts of wind direction, wind speed, and wave heights that are available to folks to look at, both on a large scale at a whole lake size scale, but also zooming in to areas like Saginaw Bay and Whitefish Bay and places like that, so you can get more detailed information.
In 2006, you co-published a paper with the American Meteorological Society analyzing the storm of November 1975, which sunk the Edmund Fitzgerald. And you wrote that there were 31 surface weather observations from ships in Lake Superior. Were those observations reported to NOAA? And was that the predominant way to get observations back then?
Yeah, at the time, the observations would typically be radioed in through the Coast Guard, and then basically from there, they would get passed along into the communication systems of the time. So they would find their way, obviously, into NOAA and into the hands of the National Weather Service. The communication was obviously a little bit slower than the speed at which it works today, but the number of observations was dramatically less than we have now, and there were no automated observations. And by automated, I mean the buoys that are located in the lakes and also surface observing stations along the shoreline, which nowadays that information is collected continuously and makes its way into the hands of forecasters, you know, around the clock 24/7, you know, every few minutes or in some cases, maybe once an hour. But it's a very dramatically different situation today in terms of the number of observations that we have available to know what's going on, because it's, you know, very difficult, if not impossible, to forecast the future conditions if you don't have a good handle on what's occurring in the current at the current time.
Yeah, and I'm guessing that you had some buoys in the water back then, and certainly do now, but in whether it's then or now, they're pretty much taken out of the water in November, right? So just because to protect them from ice and wind in the winter. Whether it was in 1975 or today, I'm guessing there were buoys in the water. But in both cases, they're taken out in November. What's the case on buoys being used in the water to get weather information?
Sure. Actually, an interesting effect of the tragedy of the Fitzgerald was that it actually led to the establishment of the buoys in the Great Lakes. The buoys in Lake Superior were actually put in after the Fitzgerald incident occurred, and they were put in during the late 70s, 1979, I believe, was when the buoys found their way into Lake Superior. But as you suggested, during the winter months, the buoys in the Great Lakes are typically removed to prevent them from being damaged by ice flows and other things that happen. So typically they're removed in late fall and then not restored again until the spring. That being said, though, the peak of the shipping season, especially on Lake Superior, is prior to that time because the locks in Sault Ste. Marie also close as we move into the winter months. And then any of the shipping on Lake Superior is generally just intra-lake within the lake itself. But the data from the buoys is invaluable, even when during the seasons when we have it available. It not only helps to verify and validate forecast information, but it also helps provide a sense of climatology and what expectations should be, and tie or compare observations that we receive from ships to nearby buoys, because there are errors and observations from humans as well on the ships. And a lot of times, as humans, we often tend to report kind of the worst conditions that we see during a period of time, whereas the data we get from buoys kind of averages that out. And one of the things we forecast is what's called significant wave height, which is essentially the average wave heights of the top 33% of waves. So it isn't the peak wave height, it's sort of what waves you're most likely to encounter at the higher end. So it's a little bit of a different thing, but the buoys themselves are invaluable and used, you know, to this day. And now there are more buoys than ever because there have been additional buoys over time that have been installed by universities and other research facilities.
So Tom, how do you take limited data, and maybe limited data is the wrong term, but I'm assuming that the data you had to record that storm in 1975 was certainly more limited than you would have today if you were doing predictions and forecasting and looking at a storm. So how do you take limited data from 1975 and assess what was going on by using modern technologies? Where do you start?
Yeah, as you pointed out, you have extremely limited data. So you really, it's not as if you can take observations and interpolate in between them to figure out what occurred. What you basically have to do is kind of recreate everything and create or do what we call as a hindcast. So we look at the information we have that's the most readily available and that we have the highest confidence in. And what that is with respect to the atmospheric data. So that's the data that we have that tells us what were the weather conditions, not only across the Great Lakes, but the U.S. and even the globe at that time. And those conditions are things like the temperatures, the pressure, the wind direction and wind speeds from the ground all the way up through the atmosphere. And what were they over that region and over the United States and, an even larger area throughout the duration of that storm. And believe it or not, we actually have what is called reanalysis data. So every day, twice a day around the world, weather balloons are sent up to collect a lot of weather information from the surface all the way up through the atmosphere. There's also numerous surface observing weather stations around the country. And there were even back in the 70s at all of your airports and places like that, there were ship observations. And the weather models ingest all of that information. So these are computer programs that just ingest data. And they make basically their best guess at what the observed conditions were at that time. Also incorporating, although at that time it was somewhat limited, but any satellite data and other sorts of remotely sensed data. And from that, we would call it a gridded database, but just think of it as a computer database of weather information. We can then take that and run a modern weather forecast model, which is much more sophisticated than what would have been available back in the 70s. And we can essentially give it an initial condition or what were the conditions, at 6 p.m., on November 9th. And then we can basically tell that computer program or that weather model to then forecast out through the duration of the storm. In this case, the storm that occurred during the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And it will provide us the details, at a higher resolution or a more detailed picture throughout the course of that storm. And also as frequently as we want, every hour, every 15 minutes, to sort of fill in those blanks. And once we have that weather information, we can use that to then take a similar computer program or model that generates wave height information or wave conditions and give it the weather information. And it will give us estimates of what the marine conditions were during the storm. So very complex process. It's hard to explain it in full details, but essentially you take a limited data set and you feed it into a very complex computer program that is solving, the equations of the atmosphere and the physics to then try to fill in the details for you.
Well, what data did you actually have from 1975?
It would mainly be, the information I sort of alluded to in terms of weather observations from airports across the country, balloon observations, so weather balloons that are launched twice a day around the country and around the world, observations from ships, some limited satellite information at the time that would have been quite limited. And then all of that data is basically put in and the term we use is assimilated, and we're not talking about the Borg in Star Trek here. It's assimilated in that information is used to create a more complete whole or a better complete picture of what the conditions were.
Where did the storm start? It didn't start like on Lake Superior, right?
No, like many of the storms that impact the Great Lakes and in the Midwest part of the U.S., it began as sort of a weak disturbance that moved out of the southern Rocky Mountains. And basically as it moved out into the plains and then lifted northeast, it intensified just due to some of the favorable conditions in the atmosphere. And as it continued to move northeast, it basically intensified significantly from the time it emerged into the southern plains, moved across Iowa, and eventually across Lake Superior and into Ontario. So you have a fairly weak system when it first emerged, but as it lifted north and northeast, it strengthened, and really conditions, you know, as it did that, deteriorated rapidly across the lakes. And also you had changing conditions when the ships set out. You know, you had winds from more of an easterly direction, but as time passed, the winds shifted around to the north and eventually the northwest and the west as that storm continued to move northeast.
Did I read correctly that really it seemed like the worst part of the storm was really somewhat localized and right where the Fitzgerald was?
Yes, to a large extent. As you know, we kind of discussed earlier in terms of, you know, your potential to build your biggest waves is over the point where you have the longest fetch or the longest distance over the water that the strong winds can kind of take. And as you got into the latter parts of that storm on November 10th in the late afternoon and evening, the wind was more from a west or west-northwest direction. So they were essentially going from the northwestern shore of Lake Superior, say near Thunder Bay, Ontario, and traveling across almost the entire, you know, width of Lake Superior into the southeast corner of the lake near Whitefish Point, which is where the Fitzgerald was traveling toward. And during that afternoon and into the evening was also when the winds got to their strongest. So really the winds strengthened during the afternoon, the waves continued to build, and the worst conditions that we simulated during the storm were pretty much from, you know, say 5 to 9 p.m. Eastern time, which is essentially, you know, during the time frame when the Fitzgerald was lost.
Boy, this is I'm asking you a tough question here, but after having done all the kind of modern numerical modeling, to take the storm or the information you had from 1975, November 1975, and inserted it, could you possibly walk us through what the Fitzgerald was seeing and the Anderson at that point, if they were in the worst of it? And I know you've described it. I'm just trying to come from a different direction. I want it's until you're in a storm like that and on a ship, maybe hard to understand. But I guess I just want to have our listeners truly get a sense of what this storm was like at that moment.
Sure. You know, and maybe I'll take it back a little bit earlier, you know, perhaps earlier in the late in the morning into the early part of the afternoon when the ships were a little bit north of those worst conditions. They were seeing winds that were from a northerly direction that were shifting, and they were shifting around to the northwest and the west as the afternoon progressed. And that change in the wind direction was somewhat coincident with when the ships were also turning. They had been heading somewhat easterly, but then the ships started to turn south, and they were heading not exactly due south, but you know, they're heading pretty much to the south toward the shelter of Whitefish Bay during the same time frame that the wind direction that had been more northerly was shifting more to the west, and it was also strengthening. So what you kind of think of if you put yourself, you know, in their shoes, so to speak, would be you would be moving into an area where the conditions are getting worse, the winds are increasing in speed. Basically, you're getting more and more wind gusts up near hurricane force. There were observations of hurricane force winds, and our simulations also produced those with sustained wind speeds that were 50 to 60 miles an hour. So, you know, those aren't gusts. That's just sustained winds that are very strong. And over that period of time, those are building the waves. So where you had 15 to 20 foot waves, which sound, you know, very significant to those of us that, you know, are apt to get seasick. But those waves increased as you moved into the late afternoon on the 10th, and especially, you know, around 6 to 7 p.m. time frame, there wasn't much in the way of specific observations, but the simulations that we performed, which matched other available observations and in which we have a fair degree of confidence, showed you had significant waves building upwards of 25 feet during that time period in the late afternoon into the early evening. And with significant wave heights, which I mentioned earlier, are sort of the average of the highest third of the waves, those would be the waves you'd be seeing quite frequently. That would be very disruptive, obviously. But then in addition to that, you would have waves that were outliers, because waves fall within a distribution. So there are waves that are much higher. And that number of a significant wave of 25 feet means you could occasionally within that distribution see, you know, a wave or, you know, a few waves that would be 40 feet or more. So extremely significant. And the other big factor that they were dealing with is because they were heading southerly and the winds were mostly from the west, northwest, or west, the wave direction was basically coming at them broadside, so to speak. So they weren't heading, they didn't have a choice of being able to head more into the seas or having a following sea. This was hitting them, you know, on the side, which obviously would be very disruptive in terms of a rolling action and really make things difficult. So really, they were just grappling with the conditions at about their worst they were during the storm, and they didn't have much of a choice or any way to avoid it with where they were trying to get and the direction from which they were coming.
So while captains, knowing that a squall's coming, would take a northerly route before having to turn south, that would be normal, but they would also be expecting kind of normal is the wrong term, but have a certain expectation from their experience as captains on what the winds might be like, even in a squall as they turn south. And it sounds like they really hit something unusual.
Yeah, I think that says it pretty well. It was outside of their experience of what they would typically expect with the forecast that they were given at the time in terms of they were thinking of more of a north or a northwest wind, I think. And as time passed, you know, they had that, but eventually it became a bit more westerly, perhaps earlier than what they would have expected and at a stronger intensity. And, you know, to a large extent, that was just a limitation, you know, of the forecasts of the day in terms of being able to give you the specifics, both magnitude and timing, you know, that's available to folks nowadays. So it's hard to believe you could be caught by surprise, but you certainly could be much more easily, you know, back in the 70s than would be the case now.
Yeah, you know, nowadays you have far better ability to understand the weather. Now, we do know from the sinking of the El Faro, which was not in the Great Lakes, that weather went into a hurricane and it also perished. So it can happen in more modern times. But I will mention to our listeners that if you've been listening to North Coast Chronicles on our second podcast ever, I interviewed my brother, Russ, who was a captain, a Great Lakes freighter captain, now retired, and asked him, what's the highest wave you ever hit? And he said, that's the most common question he would ever get. And he said, 20 feet. And so for him, 20 foot wave seemed pretty big. Try to imagine, you know, doubling that, especially with the wind being so bad. He also expressed that he too had been in a storm when he was just a third mate, where the captain went into really bad weather and the hatch started to come off and it was not a great situation. And I asked him how he felt about what it was like to run a ship at that point. And he said he always went to anchor. He said it wasn't worth damage to the ship, putting people's lives in any danger. You don't have to get there so fast that it's worth it. He said you go to anchor and you ride it out. And a lot to be said for that. And in fairness to the folks that went out that night, the information they had, you know, gave them enough confidence that they could weather it like they always have. But in that case, it was worse. And just back in 1975, you know, again, didn't have the same access to real-time information that they did. Hey, Tom, I also read that, and I think I said this earlier on, that at that time in 1975, because of being in the middle of the squall, the Fitzgerald could not be, this is before it went down, could not be seen on radar. Was that pretty typical? And how do we continue to view, can we see now better? Is the technology better to be able to see where a ship is?
Yeah, you know, that question would be maybe a little bit beyond my expertise in terms of radar that ships would have on board and their ability to see other ships, because the type of radar I deal with most often is weather radar, where we're looking at you know, the rain and the snowfall that's more up in the clouds and in the atmosphere. But, you know, what I would say is I've seen, you know, an an incredible, I would almost say insane amount of advancement in weather radar technology during my 30-year career. And I can only imagine that they have seen the same with respect to, you know, shipboard radar technology as well.
I don't mean this is a loaded question. I truly don't. But are there areas for the Great Lakes in particular that you think could use some advocacy? And I truly don't mean this as a political question of funding or anything like that. But and I could even rephrase it. Are there areas in which you think there are advances need to be made in terms of weather predictions and analysis that would be particularly helpful to the Great Lakes?
Yeah, I think, you know, we've seen a lot of improvement in the areas that, at least when I was working, you know, along the Great Lakes before I moved to Minneapolis, a lot of the issues we dealt with at that time where we felt there was a weakness, so to speak, was with observations. And that certainly has improved over the past 10 to 15 years in terms of additional buoys from universities and research stations, and a lot of additional observation sites that are along the shoreline, because at that time we felt we had come a long way in improving forecasts and having better data and information for the large lake carriers. But we did feel we still lacked accuracy and specificity in the forecasts in the near shore waters. That was, you know, more for recreational boaters, but also commercial fishermen and folks just with smaller vessels. And that's where there'd been a lot of push and a lot of work to get more observations in those nearshore waters to provide better detail on differences in wind direction and wind speed that occur in some of these areas where you have, you know, smaller bays, you know, peninsulas, where you have changes in terrain height that really influence the wind direction and wind speed along the coast. So I think we've seen a lot of improvement there, at least from what I can look at now as an outsider to the Great Lakes forecasting. But I would still imagine that, you know, there's room for improvement, basically in improving the detail of forecast information. And what goes into that is observations, both of the winds, the temperatures, even water temperatures play a big role. So I can't think of anything specific, but I know that more detailed observations always lead into better forecasts, and the models that we have available will use whatever data, you know, is given to them. And the better the data is and the more information there is, the better output you're given from when you perform these numerical simulations.
Roger that. Good data in gets you better data out. Back in 1975, 31 vessels radioed in the surface weather situation. But isn't there something more automatic these days? Doesn't NOAA work with the vessels to get some automatic feeds on weather?
Yeah, the observations today are much more automated. They come in, you know, more frequently. Certain aspects are fully automated in terms of wind observations from certain platforms. You know, some of the ship observations are still semi-manual in terms of wave heights. Obviously, the ships don't really have a way of giving you a real-time wave height in an automated fashion like a buoy does. So that still does depend on a human being kind of looking at the sea state conditions and giving you their best estimate of those conditions. But if we know the winds, if we have a really good idea of what the winds are, we can derive what the waves are, at least within a very, you know, small margin of error. We can get a pretty good estimate of what the wave conditions are going to be if we know what the winds are and we know what the air temperatures are and we know what the water temperatures are, which is why there's always been a push for getting more and more of that information into the models so that we can simulate the wave heights with as much accuracy as possible.
I kind of talked about this, the storm that the Edmund Fitzgerald hit was kind of a perfect storm. But storms and these kind of incidents are not really that rare, right?
That's true. We get intense storms, you know, every season that affect some portion of the Great Lakes. And every few years we get storms that are, you know, at the higher envelope or even more intense. And when we looked back, when we did our research and we looked at some of the sort of climatological hindcasts where they basically try to recreate the conditions over the lakes over a long period of time to get a sense of, you know, what the normals are and what the outliers are. What we saw when we looked at that data was a storm, you know, similar to that of the November 1975 storm, on Lake Superior, a storm like that, that produces, you know, 50 knot sustained winds and hurricane force gusts, along with wave heights of, you know, significant wave heights of 25 feet or so, something like that actually happens on the order of every 2 to 5 years. So although rare, it's not that unusual. What is unusual, though, is for any specific individual or any specific ship to find themselves out in such a storm and also in the worst part of that storm at the worst possible time. So the conditions do happen, which sets you up for, that's why you have to be aware of these risks and know what to do to avoid them. So it is rare, but they do happen. And it's nowadays, thankfully, much more avoidable in terms of the improvements in observations and in forecasts.
And, you know, I think one of the other things to realize is that this was a tough storm, and it was tough for the Anderson, right? It was tough for anybody out there. And trying to find the Fitzgerald in the middle of that was virtually impossible, especially because the ships themselves didn't have modern enough equipment to be able to, well, and the ships didn't have GPS on them. They didn't have transponders on them, and the ability to see the ship, you know, through GPS. So it was a little more challenging. Tom, after you did this numerical modeling to look from 1975 and using modern technologies, were there any real surprises? And, you know, where did your assumptions hold up?
Yeah, I think the biggest surprise to us, or I guess I wouldn't say surprise, but it was, you know, somewhat alarming, was when we really looked at the output when it came out and finally looked at it and looked at where the worst sort of conditions that we were able to simulate, and we saw what time they occurred and where they occurred. And then we compared that to the track of the Fitzgerald and just saw this, you know, perfect overlay, so to speak, of where it was traveling and when, and just, it couldn't have been in a worse place at a worse time, basically. And it was just, you know, eye-opening and also just upsetting to realize that, you know, a ship, you know, going through a similar part of the lake 6 hours earlier or 6 hours later, you know, would have avoided those conditions. And, you know, all other things being equal, would not have, you know, run into the same problems. It's interesting, though, in subsequent years, I think a few years after this, the National Weather Service has a program where we do familiarization floats, we call them, where we get to ride aboard these vessels and actually see the Great Lakes ourselves. And I actually was able to ride on the Arthur Anderson because it's still out there working on the lakes. And I actually took a ride along the Anderson from Marquette to Duluth, you know, so not a long trip, just, you know, half a day, basically. But it was really amazing to be out there. And then you really could see, you know, how isolated you are once you get out into the middle of Lake Superior in terms of not being able to see another ship or land, and realizing, you know, how frightening it would be to be out there in this sort of a storm.
Thank you. That's a really great program to get you out there. It helps you understand what the needs of the mariners are, and in particular on these commercial freighters, because they're different. I mean, we think, oh, they're so tall and so big and have so much freeboard and, you know, waves aren't going to make a difference. But like you said, only in the Great Lakes do you have a vessel as old as the Anderson still working. And the reason some of these old ships still work, folks, is one, it's in operating in fresh water, so they don't have the same kind of wear and tear as if they were in salt water. But secondly, some of these older ships are a bit smaller than I would call the more recent ships, because there aren't many new ships. And they can get up rivers into places that some of these, you know, 1,000-foot ships can't get to. So it makes every sense that they still operate. But I'm glad you got to be on the Anderson. I'm sure it was an incredible experience. Well, I'm going to change the subject just to a little more light, only because we do talk about this once in a while on North Coast Chronicles. And I understand that you're kind of a beer aficionado. And we know there's lots of good beer up there in the lakes. So where are you finding your good beer?
Interesting question for you to ask me. And yeah, I definitely am. And I've been fortunate to spend a lot of time in both Michigan and Minnesota, both of whom have, you know, really vibrant and excellent, you know, craft beer industry in terms of lots of breweries and lots of places to go. And I'm not going to call out anyone individually. Part of that is, I don't want to forget anyone and leave someone out. You know, I will say that I've here in the Minneapolis area in the Twin Cities, you know, there's upwards of 50 breweries that are accessible within a short span of time. And as luck would have it, my wife, Lindsay, she actually works for the Minnesota Craft Brewers Guild. So she helps plan and set up a lot of the beer festivals and things that we have around the state. So that's something that I try to enjoy, especially during the summertime when the weather is wonderful here in the lakes, is to get outside and enjoy some of that craft beer. And I did the same thing when I lived in Marquette. We also had a really great festival there every fall. So definitely something to enjoy. And I think something the Great Lakes excel at, especially, you know, the places I've lived.
Well, thank you. And how lucky for you that your wife, Lindsay, is directly involved. You get the inside scoop on what's coming up. It sounds like fun. And Tyler, I know you're listening, but you don't have to respond. But boy, do we need both a wine tour and a beer tour of the Great Lakes. We keep talking about doing a circle tour, and we'll check in with you, Tom, to find out what, some places to go. But thank you. I can't thank you enough for sharing your expertise on the storm on Lake Superior in November of 1975. Just an extraordinary experience. And thank you for helping our listeners to understand the incredible work of the National Weather Service and for your long service, because what you guys do is a service and it's incredibly appreciated.
Well, thank you once again for having me. It was really a joy to speak with you folks today. And I can't wait to listen to this in future podcasts.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. So folks, while the gales of November have prompted many a folklore, the role of timely and accurate weather observations remains one of the most important tools for a mariner in the Great Lakes and around the world. Our thanks to merchant mariners everywhere who spend their career at sea to support the economy and quality of life. Thank you so much for joining us in North Coast Chronicles, Tales from the Great Lakes. I'd love to hear from you. Send any comments or ideas for shows or on information to become a sponsor to northcoastchronicles@gmail.com. Please join us next month on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts as we continue our Great Lakes adventure. Until then, be good to one another.